Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hey, Guy.
How are you?
I'm good. Big one. Yes, it's a big one this week, isn't it?
It's a very big one. And it kind of feeds on from last week in that this guy was a major influence on The Clash.
Of course. Mick Jones was a big fan and went to all the shows. In fact, isn't there a producer? What producer?
Yeah, he co-produced an album with Mick Ronson in 1981. It was Short Back and Sides.
That's right. That's right. Now, I've got a question for you.
Yes.
And it's, what do you think could be the greatest intro of a record ever?
Right. Now, I'm assuming this is loaded and that you want me to say.
I don't, because I want to say that. It's, for me, All the Young Dudes is one of the greatest intros ever.
Oh, no, it's one of the greatest intros ever. For me, it's always going to be Bubba O'Reilly.
There you go. There's another one. Mark Radcliffe cleverly said that the intro of All the Young Dudes was the Chimes of Freedom.
Yes, it is. It's very much that, yeah.
I mean, Ziggy Stardust is probably another one, but that sound at the beginning, which is hardly repeated in the song.
It's funny you say Ziggy Stardust, because it's a Ronson guitar riff, isn't it? I don't know if Ronson played it, but it's exactly the same sort of motif at the start of Ziggy and the start of All the Young Dudes.
It's a question to ask Ian, because I don't know if that was Mick Ralphs or Ronson. I mean, obviously Bowie produced that record and Bowie wrote it. Did Mick play on it? Whatever happens. I mean, Mick
and Ian have got big history already by this point.
But sorry,
they went on.
Ronno rather than Mick, because it's Mick Ralphs too,
right.
so we'll get confused.
It's Mick and Ronno, yes.
But Mick Ralphs, because his guitar sound on that whole album with the choked off wah wah to be a bit technical, sounds so Ronson.
It's very Ronson, yeah.
But anyway,
but it's funny. Do you know what I'm talking about? Because I remember. Actually, no. We should be. Hang on. I've got stuff that this should all be saved. Should all be saved for our legendary guest.
Yes, it should. But this intro thing might be an idea for a midweek special.
I think this could very, very well be an idea for a special. And it'd be quite interesting if our listeners want to put in ideas of what they think is the greatest intro. For instance, I know that this was put in my head by Johnny Marr, right? As so many things are. Gimme Shelter is the greatest intro of all time.
Right. Tumbling Dice is very close to that. Listen,
yeah,
that's got that great guitar lick that never reappears.
This is a great game, isn't it? This is one that you can sit in the pub with this all night long. So yes, tell us what you think is the greatest.
In fact, you can sit in the pub all the day and all the night, and have another great intro
right through till the Waterloo sunset.
I think, yeah. Listen, we're opening this up to all you guys to send us some social media ideas on this, and maybe we could get together and have a midweek special.
Yes, this is in fact going out to all the young dudes.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a party. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience? Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Ah! Hello.
Hello. That's the most famous hello in the business, Ian.
Well, three of them, yeah. Hello.
Brilliant. Hello, Ian. I'm Guy.
I'm Gary.
Guy, nice to meet you.
Listen, Ian, thank you so much for coming on. I've been badgering your daughter to get you on for quite a long time now. But Defiance Part 1, this new album, Guy and I are absolutely loving it. It's one of the best albums I think you've ever released. It's so incredible. And I mean, what a list of people on it. And possibly Jeff Beck's last guitar solo, I think, is on one of the tracks.
It was. It's on Defiance 2. He does one on Defiance 1 and he does one on Defiance 2. And apparently the one on Defiance 2, which is not actually a solo, he's just playing along. But apparently, according to his manager, that was the last thing he did.
So with this album, was no one ever in the room together? Was it all locked down or did you all...
Andy York's a guy that I've been working with for a long, long time. He plays guitar for Mellencamp. And he came over with a computer and a little black box and a little keyboard. And we sort of made demos. And the demos turned into... We sent them down to the studio, a guy called James Fazy. He turned them into something that sounded pretty good, you know. And then we just send them out, stems. And a friend of mine, Ross Halfin, and my new
man. I know, Ross, the photographer.
Yeah. Well, Ross, you know, can be very persuasive, you know. The next thing I knew, you know, Billy Gibbons wanted to do something and Slash wanted to do something. And I'm not sure these people really wanted to do something or Ross forced them.
No.
Come on.
I find that hard to believe. The thing is, actually, because going back through all of your albums, Ian, which has been an absolute joy, because you actually always have pretty stellar lineups. You just don't have a different stellar lineup on every song.
No, that's true. I slowly realised, I've played with some great people. I mean, it's quite embarrassing sometimes. I always remember sitting in the toilet when, what's his name, the alto sax player.
Xambon?
Yeah, he was doing a solo. I was producing. I was sitting on the toilet crying.
No!
Are we talking about All American Alien Boy here?
Yeah. I think it was, it might have been You Really Did Me. One of those, you know.
Oh, like, but hang on, we're getting off of this new album, but You Really Did Me, now you've mentioned it, which has got, I think it's got Freddie Mercury and Roger Taylor and Brian all singing backing vocals on it. And of course, it's incredible Xambon sax solo. But what a song that is, Ian. What a song. And if anyone has never heard, you have to go and listen to You Nearly Did Me In. It does me in every time I hear it.
Oh, thanks.
But that whole album, I mean, everything. I mean, the whole lineup. I mean, and
yeah.
Probably the only rock album ever done by I believe he was then pretty much unknown, wasn't he? Jaco Pastorius.
Yeah, well, Jaco was 21.
Jeez.
And
how did you find him?
He had this big ego, but it was healthy. It was great. You know what I mean? It was before he went to LA, and everybody told him how wonderful he was. You know.
Because his playing is so restrained. It's amazing.
Yeah, he was staying at Bobby Columbia's. It was just across the river from us. And he got fed up because Bobby was kind of like auditioning him in front of all these people. And he just, he was a Stones fan, you know, and it was like he wound up living with us for a month. And we went down Electric Lady and, you know, the rest is sort of 45 years ago. Whatever.
But catching up with what Guy was saying about playing with so many great musicians, this idea of you and a fantastic guitar player, you know, whether it's Mick, it's always been there, hasn't it? Whether it's Mick Ralphs or whether it's Ronno or whether it's Earl Slick, and then on this album, the album opens up with Slash, you know, and then we've got Jeff Beck on the second track, and I mean, the Ringo. Mike Campbell is fantastic on it. And Ringo, I mean, listen, Better Roses. I just want to focus in on Better Roses, which is out now. And the lyrics, I love. They are so Ian Hunter. They're about a rock and roll place. They're about the life of a rock and roller, which you've written about so many times. I mean, you're an incredible diarist of this genre. Does the Bed of Roses exist as a club? Have I just missed this somehow?
It was based on the Star Club, Hamburg.
Right.
We'd also played, you know, a few other places too. So there was another couple of verses I pulled out because all these guys wound up in jail or something, and the guys that ran the clubs. But the clubs were amazing, especially the Star Club. You know, you didn't go to bed for 3 days, and I wasn't doing uppers or anything. It was just so exciting, you know. Right bang in the middle of San Paolo, you know. It's all, you know, every genre known to mankind in the street, you know. And Ringo, Andy and I were downstairs, and I'm thinking, this is a head nodder, you know, it's around 117. And so we sent it to Ringo, and it was like, well, if I like it, I'll do it. If I don't like it, I won't. And about 4 or 5 days later, it came back, and it was perfect. You know, it's the same with Mike Campbell.
Absolutely. Did you tell Ringo it was about the Star Club?
No, I didn't, but yeah, you know, the lyrics there, you know, I figure you've got lyrics with it, put it like that.
Who's Roy? You mentioned someone called Roy. Roy in the lyric, is that right?
Yeah, Roy Young. That's Roy Young was a keyboard player and a singer back when it wasn't Ready Steady Go. It was one of those 6-5 special, I think it was. Sounded like Little Richard. And Little Richard was my idol, you know, him and Jerry Lee. And Roy could do it. And I said, how do you do that? And he said, well, you know, if you're singing something in C, do it in F instead. And, you know, take it half an octave up. And he said, I found that out quite by accident. So Roy was at the Star Club, and Roy was resident pianist there. And the Beatles played there twice when Roy was the resident pianist.
Right.
And McCartney's asked him to join the Beatles. And he didn't, because Horst Fascher had bought him a Cadillac car. And he was kind of like the king of the Star Club. You know, he could get up and play with anybody.
Yeah.
And he just turned it down. And I said to him later on when he was living in Canada, how do you feel about turning down the Beatles? He said, it's great. You know, I get up every morning, I go in the bathroom, bang my head against the wall once.
That's a beautiful line you've put in there then. Roy stays forever young. You sing in one chorus, don't you?
Yeah.
Which is absolutely... And there's another track on the album which is also about rock and roll, you know, and it's This Is What I'm Here For, and I just love the energy in that, you know. It's I think you say something like I gave up when I was 30 or something.
Yeah
Well, what's the lyric, Ian?
Well, you know, I'm a journalist, you know, I was 29 when I joined Mott, you know, so you were supposed to be 18, you know.
Yeah.
So Rono said, take 7 years off and just say it doesn't count because you're in hospital. Typical one. But yeah, I mean, they thought I was too old for it then. And here I am, you know, like 50 odd years later.
Because, Guy, I mean, that lyric, you know, which is, I think we all want to live by, this is what I'm here for. This is what I'm here for, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, if you don't mind me just mentioning your age, Ian, you know, 83. Yeah. This, and you're making music that is so fresh and so amazing, and saying this is what I'm here for. You know, and I think it's a great anthem for all of us.
But this is something that runs through all your work, all the way back through Mott and everything. Is songs about music?
That's what I do. You know what I mean? It's I would do factory stuff and all that because I've been in factories, but. You really write about your surroundings, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
What you're aware of at the time, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Saturday Gigs Guy. I mean, it's got one of the greatest lines in any song, which is, I was ready to quit, but then I went to Croydon. I mean, and that is so anthemic when you get to that, Ian.
Fairfield Hall, right?
Fairfield Hall.
It used to be the Greyhound. You played the pub, the Greyhound, which was a big pub. I mean, it held about 500 people. And when you filled that to overflowing, you went across the road, you know, to the Fairfield Hall. And that was the big deal. And they all came with us. And that was the longest reception Mott ever got. They clapped for 10 minutes. And we just stood there listening to it. It was a big deal going across the road in Croydon, you know, from the Greyhound to the Fairfield, yeah.
But you're right. But there is something because we played Fairfield Halls, Gary and I, together. This was last year, and it's the first time I'd ever played it. And there is something, even the Fairfield Hall, Croydon. There's something about it. It fits into the mythology along with Madison Square Gardens and the Budokan. There's something about Fairfield Hall.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what it is.
Neither do I. But we, when Mott went to the Eurus Theatre in New York and did the week in the Eurus Theatre in New York. That's why we did it, because we walked in there and it just looked like the Fairfield Hall. And we figure, you know, well, we do that, we can do this.
Yeah. And of course, it was famous. Bowie did a famous shows there. And I think Pink Floyd, didn't they? The guy, have I got that wrong? Did Floyd actually play
there? I'm not related there. Everyone. Yeah, everyone.
Everyone.
I remember in Elton John's diaries, he talks about like going to see The Who there and going to see, so, you know, it's where he's going, even though it seems a long way out of the way for him.
It's a regular gig, you know, like the Lyceum, you know, like.
Yeah, the Lyceum.
Yeah,
come
yeah.
on.
But going back to this new album, we mentioned Ringo, whose drumming sounds so full of life, and it is so Ringo, yeah. And it's brilliant just to have him still playing and still there. But then you've got Taylor Hawkins. That's got to be, I have to say, I hate to say this again, but is this Taylor's last recording?
I don't know, but he was going to do it all. He was very ambitious about both albums, and he was going to do it all. He did 7 in the end. He did 3 on the first one and 4 on the second. And then the COVID started easing off, so the Foos started going out again, you know, so it got phased out. But that was a total shock. I mean, that was a horrible... great guy, you know, I just right out of the blue. That hits everybody, obviously.
Yeah, that really did.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm confused because we got sent Defiance Part 1. And when is Part 2 coming out? What is...
I don't know. It's about 70% done, you know. And Andy's on the road with Mellencamp till July, I think. So we'll probably finish it in July and it'll come out, I don't know, late this year or early next year.
I just like the philosophy behind you. Say, you know, there's none of that, oh, this is might be my last album bullshit. No, you bring out an album saying Defiance, well, yeah. Part 1.
Part 1, yeah.
No, you're exactly right, yeah. That's exactly what it means, you know. It's like a big FU to people who, you know, talk about your age and all the rest of it, you know.
Exactly. There's a track on there, it's when I was listening to one of the songs, it sounded like it might be about your dad. And I know you'd written a song before, Ships, which sounded like it was about your dad. Is it No Hard Feelings? No, it's not. It is No Hard Feelings. Is that about your father?
Yeah, yeah. Got the bear. I got the what was it? What's the gig in Glasgow?
Barrowlands.
I got the Barrowlands in the lyric. I really wanted to do that. I love that gig, yeah.
It's a sprung floor, isn't it? That's why everyone goes mental there.
I've always wanted to play there, and we finally got there with Mott 74, you know, a couple of years back. And that was a buzz. That was a total buzz because it's only like 15 miles from where I lived when I was a kid.
Yeah. Oh, right. And that's what you say.
That's right. Because you grew up Scotland. You're from Oswestry, right?
And then I was there 3 months, then Hitler found out, and we had to move north. You know? We lived in a place called Hamilton, and which is about 15 miles from Glasgow. My mum worked in Glasgow, and I stayed with an aunt because my aunt would have gone into munitions, and that was the deal. My mum had a good education, so she went and worked for Boots the chemist while the war was on, you know, and I stayed with my aunt in Hamilton, 15 miles away. And my dad was in the army, you know.
And how long were you in Scotland? All I'm into is, why don't you sound Scottish?
I was 6 when we left. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I can do it. I can do the Gaelic.
But what was your connection with your dad that leaves you, you know, all these years later still? I just want to say, Guy, did you know Barry Manilow had a hit?
I know. I was waiting for the moment to throw this in. What was that like? Because that was the question I wanted to ask. What's it like when Barry Manilow covers your song?
It's strange because what it was Clive Davis, because Clive would always...
Of course it was, yeah.
You know, if he liked a song, he would. When the artist came in, he would just play it in the background. And I think his father had just died, and he took to it, you know. But he's a kind of an arranger type guy, so he would do it, and you know, he modulated it here and there. And I was kind of like nonplussed when I heard it. It was so different the way he approached it, you know. I know it would be fashionable to slag him off and all that, but he's really good in his own way at what he does, you know.
Yeah,
it is really good. It's one of those things at the time. It's like. I mean, even how we used to be about ABBA, isn't it? When you look back, you just, you know, quality is quality, isn't it? You know?
It went top 10. It went top 10 in America, didn't it?
It was huge.
It got to 10, I think it was. Yeah.
But what is it about your dad that still leaves you writing about him all these years later? What was that relationship, and how come it's still so strong within you?
Well, you know, it's after the war. You know, they came back from a war and were confronted by Elvis. You know what I mean? My dad was a cop as well. He wound up in MI5. So we were total opposites, you know. I was out of there when I was 16. But I respected him and admired him. You know, he was just a different type of person altogether.
And so if we're going to go back that far, so what was your moment? Was it, you said, was confronted by Elvis? Was it like you heard Elvis on the radio or...?
Well, it was Luxembourg, wasn't it? Little Richard, I mean, that's what everybody was doing, and it was infuriating because it would always go quiet you know, when the in the best bit of the song, you know, that Luxembourg came out, you know. And yeah, I think that's what a lot of people were doing. And to me, it was like, oh, well, this is what I'm here for. I was a fan. I never thought I'd actually be in the business. I'm, you know, wasn't like I was a musician or anything. That just sort of came along slowly. But I was a total fan. Yeah. I saw Sam Cooke. I saw Buddy Holly. I saw Little Richard. I saw Joe.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I just wanted to point out one little thing. I'm really sorry to interrupt, because I noticed you said that, because you've always had a real strong association with guitarists, either, you know, like you had Mick, you had Ronno, you had all sorts. But because you mentioned Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis, because what is interesting is there's always really strong piano in your work. You see, that seems to be a very important thing to you.
Well, what happens is, if you write on your own, your left hand becomes the drums.
Yeah, you know? Right.
Yeah, and I do write. All this album was written on piano, apart from two tracks, I think. And yeah, my left hand is very percussive, you know. In fact, it hurts. I guess that's why they sound piano based, you know.
Did you study as a pianist? Because your chops are really good on piano, obviously.
No, they're not.
No. But your songwriting chops are definitely up there. But did you study at all, or did you just find it yourself? Was there a piano in the house?
I got a V5, you know, a Roland, what is it, a Korg V5 or a Roland? I've got a keyboard anyway that I like it, because you can change keys, so you can stay in C wherever you are, you know. You could detune it.
I think Gary meant back in the day, because it was guitar originally, wasn't it? Because you won a talent competition at Butlin's, right?
Yeah, that was, yeah.
Those were the days, eh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the biggest legal brothel in Britain at the time, you know. Yeah, that was fun.
So when talk us through this. You become a guitar player. Yeah. You want to be a rock and roll star, I'm taking it, Ian, at some point. And you try and form a band. Isn't it the Apex group?
I joined them on rhythm, yeah. I'd met the two of them at Butlin's. And we won this talent competition, and then you got.
Were you all on holiday? You are just all on holiday. Your families on holiday at Butlin's.
Yeah, and right. We won it, and
not red coats,
the blue coats and the red coat. Yeah, blue coats. We avoided at all times, and we go back at the end of the season because we win, and it's like Miss Titbits, Miss Rivali, and all that. So it was an interesting week there, and then everybody got flu. And we couldn't tell anybody, because that would ruin Butlin's name, you know. So sat there for a week, yeah. And then I went to Northampton and joined these two guys, and they were in this band called the Apex. And a guy called Colin York was a singer, good-looking guy, good singer. And he became Dane Hunter later, and didn't do the right sort of things, you know. So he kind of he wound up in Texas doing country and western stuff, and he died a while back. But then I went to London, you know, and piddled about in London. Wound up at Francis Day and Hunter, which was publishing.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I mean, really venerable old publisher, weren't they?
Yeah, I liked them. They were nice. Me and Roger from Deep Purple, he was there as well.
That's bizarre.
Were you staff songwriters, or were you just transcribing? What were you doing?
That's 15 quid a week. Yeah, staff.
What were you writing? What are you writing for them?
I wrote Season's Song for Nicole Williams. And I did another one. I forget what it was, but Dave Berry covered it.
Nicole Williams, the actor?
Yes.
Yeah, yep. Wow. I'd love to hear that.
The guy that signed me was the guy. What happened was I was in a factory and I wanted to get out of the factory. And so they did the Nicole Williams song, and it cost a lot of money, but they forgot to ask me for permission. So they had me in, and I said, well, I would like to get out of the factory, please. And they'd already spent £400, which was a lot of money, on Nicole Williams and Season's Song. And so I said, well, you know, give me 3 months' wages so I don't have to go in the factory all summer. And that turned into like 15 months, I think. And I joined after that.
Fantastic. If you don't mind me asking, what was the factory?
Oh, it was halfway up the Arsden Road. I forget what it was called. Me and Miller Anderson, the blues player.
Yeah. Because were you in the scenery with him?
It was around about that time, yeah. Me and Miller worked together for a while, a great guitar player. But he went with Keith Hartley, so I was left still in the factory. And then Bill Farley rings me up from Regent Sound, and Regent Sound was kind of like you know, Sun Records. It's that little four track in Denmark Street, or it was.
Yeah.
Bill Farley rang me up and he said, there's a load of hairy blokes down here auditioning and they can't find anybody they want. Would you like to come down? Because I'd been doing demos in his studio, and Bill was a Dalston boy, you know, looked both ways before he said anything. And I went down there and there was all these hairy guys, and that was the audition for Mark.
So who was that? Yeah, who was that? Who was in that room originally?
Mick Rouse was there, Pete, but they were all there, and Guy Stevens, you know.
That's right. Wasn't the band called The Silence or something like that?
Yeah, they came up from Hereford. And I wore a corduroy two-piece with sandals, and I was a bit overweight, so they weren't over-enthused about it. But Guy, for some reason, felt it was not a bad idea. And he rang me about a week later. He said, look, you look awful. Could you please come down and I want to buy you some clothes? And I was like, whoa, I'm in, you know, like. And he spent 100 quid on clothes in some place.
Blimey.
Yeah, a lot of money.
This is sort of 1969, Ian. I mean, what's the scene? Yeah. What's happening in London? What are people into? Is it Middle Earth? Is that what was happening?
I don't know, because I couldn't afford it. I was living in the Archway, you know. I don't know what was going on in the middle of London, you know.
But what was the...
Guy Stevens, he was a kind of a scenester, wasn't he? He was who people went to like put their set lists together, yeah. And he turned you on to new records, and that was his thing. Because didn't he famous... There's a great quote from him once when someone said, what attracted you to looking after Mott the Hoople? He said, they got the fucking Hammond up the stairs.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I don't give a shit, you know, you're in. Mick Rouse went down there and said,
I love
not an answer, you know. So Mick really got that started, you know. They were living in Hereford, just another band, you know, and Mick Rouse, pretty ambitious at that time. He went down and sat in Guy's office, and Island Records was a big thing, you know. I mean, it was the main place to be.
Yeah.
Guy got us in there, you know. God, loony. I mean, that's how we got in.
He was a nut job, wasn't he? He was just like kind of...
Yeah, he saw stuff.
When you could get the lid on the bottle, then it would be amazing, but then half the time the lid was off and it was just kind of...
I love the guy, I still do, but...
Who else did he produce?
I doubt anybody else would have signed us.
He produced The Clash in the end, didn't he? Who else did he produce, Guy? Well,
he wasn't really a producer. He was basically, I mean, Mott was, that was, you were his thing, weren't you? And then it was, I mean, I think The Clash, it was basically Joe and Mick just went around pubs in North London until they found him because they really wanted Guy Stevens to produce them.
Mick followed.
Isn't it?
Mick followed Mott.
I know that. No, but what I mean is I'm flash forwarding to 79 there. But I know. Mick.
Yeah,
you're an absolute. What's funny, actually, has been listening to a lot of the... listening to Mott again, is seeing actually how much influence there always was with Mick's writing from you. It was always there.
I love working with Mick. You know. What are you going to do? You know, I couldn't sing his songs.
What?
He was writing these bluesy songs, you know, Can't Get Enough of Your Love, which was like worldwide, you know, and Paul Rodgers came along and that was it.
Was he presenting those songs to you?
Yeah.
Oh,
we had Ready for Love, you know.
I always remember when you one of your Reformation tours. I remember seeing you at the Hammersmith Apollo.
I went too. Yeah,
you were there. Yeah, and I just always remember thinking because I knew Mick quite well because he used to be really good friends with David Gilmour.
Him. And Hammer, yeah.
Yeah, but I always thought he was the most perfect, definitive Les Paul Marshall sound I ever heard. That was it.
Well, that's a tricky one, isn't it? Because certainly Ronno was definitely my favourite Marshall.
No, that's your favourite sound, but I'm talking about the definitive Les Paul Marshall sound. Yeah. This is another conversation.
Ralph was the co-writer. Ralph wrote great songs, you know. Mick was a great arranger. That was the difference between the two of them.
Yeah.
They were both great guitar players, but Mick was a songwriter and actually an arranger. He had a lot to do with the Mott stuff in the studio and with Bill Price.
If you listen back to that first Mott album, and you can even hear it now in what you do, Dylan seems to be a massive influence on you, Ian.
Oh, yeah.
What was your Dylan? Were you a total Dylan head at that point when you joined Mott?
Well, I didn't quite know what he was talking about, but he was just right. And also, you know, I hadn't really ever sung. I was a bass player. And
What?
I just used him as a... I'd been playing bass for a long time, you know, when we were in Hamburg and all them kind of things.
Wow. I didn't know that.
So, yeah. In the Shriekers?
Yeah, in the Shriekers as well. Yeah, I was a bass player. Because what happened was I think I was playing guitar and singing, and then Freddie Fingers Lee came along, and so I went over onto bass and let Freddie do the singing, you know. Interesting.
Let him do the safe jobs.
Well, no, playing bass and singing is tricky, right?
Yeah.
It's tricky. It's not like playing guitar and singing.
Well, I didn't play what Fred did the singing, and I went over on bass, yeah. And I went up and down the thickest string until I found out what the other three were for, you know. And gradually, in Germany, all those clubs, you're playing 7 hours a night, you learn, you know. And by the end of that, it was like, yeah, I think I could. I might have a chance here, you know. But I thought it was going to be bass.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out. Those first, before you finally make the All the Young Dudes album and that single happens, was there a feeling that you were always treading water with those records, and that you're never quite getting yourself where you wanted to be? Was there a moment when that did happen, and then it's... I'm talking about when you finally sort of make that announcement in 72 that it's all going to come to an end.
It was all natural. I mean, the beginning of the way they played, the spirit of them, the albums they did, and the way it finished, it was all natural. Nothing was planned whatsoever. I mean, the management situation was chaotic. It's not like now where everything's set in stone, you know, planned and everything. We were just like, I mean, Roxy were planned. They had good managers, you know. I mean, we had a guy for a manager. We were managing Guy most of the time, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I remember, because you talk about managers a lot in your book, in Diary of a Rock and Roll Star, the way you explain them as these sort of hustlers and kind of like bands like horses.
Yeah, so, you know.
Which, by the way, can I just say one? It's one of my... I've always remembered when I read that book as a kid, there's one line that was stuck with. There's this great thing, because you're talking about going to America and people hadn't gone to America, right?
That's right.
And there's this great thing, you go, yeah, and you get on the plane. It's fantastic. Your seat goes back and you can watch a movie.
Yeah.
which is like the most glamorous thing.
But it's a brilliant book, isn't it? Because it takes what we see as being extremely glamorous and it just turns it into a job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You That's know. What it is, touring, really. I mean, you know, gigs are great, but, you know, getting to them and all that, you know as well as I do. I mean, it can get a little tedious after a while.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Joe Perry said, wasn't it, to us the other week? He said, you're not being paid for the gigs, you're being paid for the travel.
Yeah, he's right. Yeah. And it doesn't get any easier, you know. Kind of gets a little stupider.
So what was the point? there was a point, wasn't there, I think, when you were about to sort of give it all up and you got some sort of a call from Bowie. I don't know, how did that all happen, Ian?
Pete, we decided we finished up in a gas tank in Switzerland playing some club, you know, metal, wonderful sound. And we decided to split up and we get back to the, I don't know, wherever we got back to in England. And Pete heard Bowie was auditioning for a bass player. So Pete rang up for the bass gig. And then David said, you know, we're in Mott. And he said, no, we finished. And then they got all like a little crusade about Mott, you know. I didn't know he knew us. But he was, no, you can't do that and all the rest of it. And then Pete rang us and said, like, this bloke wants to play his songs and stuff. And he's really good. Pete loved Bowie. He was a big Bowie fan.
Because at that point, he'd only done Man Who Sold the World was... Hunky Dory maybe had come out or not?
No, I think it was in between the first single, was the first single and the first album. I think that's when we were slotted in for about a year. It went
because he offered you a song that was to be turned on Ziggy, right? Which you turned down.
Yeah,
I love that. Nah, that's not it.
At the time, he was not a big, you know, how you know him now. He was on the way up, you know, and he'd been in loads of bands as well, you know.
Yeah. So go on, carry on.
Yeah, come on.
I'm just another guy giving you songs, you know. And Suffragette said he was okay, you know, but I mean, we had okay stuff. We knew. See, the radio, we'd had a couple of singles that stiffed, so the radio was not going to play us unless it was something special. And we always thought it'd be like, You Really Got Me, The Kinks, something like that. We thought that's what we'd get. And then all of a sudden we get All the Young Dudes. And I heard it. He's sitting on the floor there playing it. And it's like, why are you giving this away? You know, this is ridiculous. And I knew I could sing it too, you know, because I'm not that wide as a singer. And I knew I could do it. And it was just two nights and that was it, you know.
Okay, where were you when he was sitting on the floor? I want to know what he looked like and what he was wearing.
Yeah. Was he cross-legged? How was he sitting?
He used to do a lot on the floor. I remember in New York, he'd have keyboards on the floor.
Yeah.
He seemed to like the floor. I think we were in a publishing place where De Vries was kind of like an apprentice. You know, I think De Vries was working there and that's where we all went. So it was in an office somewhere on Regent Street, I think.
So, but did he write it on the spot? Or
No.
Did he just have it there? Yeah, because that would be too much.
Rono told me he'd done it. They'd done it, and they'd done it in C. We took it up to D, and he'd done it using a lot of alto, where with us he used a lot of Fally, you know, the organ. He used a lot of that. And then Mick added that amazing intro, you know, and that. And he was bored with the end of it. It kept going round and going round. He said, one of the boys is a single. And we all looked at him like he was an idiot. And he's like, no. Well, the end's boring. It keeps going round and round. So I did a little chat on the end. And that was the difference.
Chat come from?
It came from the Rainbow. We used to have a heckler's 10 seconds. So, you know, people at the back could shout, fuck off, you're lousy and all the rest of it, you know. We got his mates to bring him down and he'd come down the front and I would empty a bottle of beer on him. Wouldn't go down too well these days, but back then, I remember that night at 4 a.m, we came out and he was the only guy still outside waiting for the band.
Was he wearing glasses? Was he the boy in the glasses?
I can't remember.
Yeah, because that's what you say, is it? Hey, you with the glasses, you know?
Yeah, well, that was just a blinder. But I remember him coming down. It was because I went over stage right, and I did that, you know. And of course, everybody enjoyed that. And then we had this party backstage, and we didn't finish till 4. And I go outside, just one guy there, and I think he's going to kill me, you know. But he was great, you know. We gave him autographs and all that, and he was fine.
Wow! Did he ever know it was him in the song?
I have no idea. That was it.
But who came up with that guitar riff? Was it Mick Ralphs then?
Yeah, one of the best ever.
Unbelievable.
It's one of the best ever. Because it's also because it's so... The only other person who could have come up with that is Ronno.
Yeah.
So, but it's... Because Ronno was involved in the production of All the Young Dudes, wasn't he, as well? Or was he not?
Not so much.
Oh, okay, I thought he was.
He did a bit on the Dudes album. He did a hospital arrangement on one of them. But no, it was David. And we don't know where that stuff's gone, you know. I'd have liked a thicker mix. But Dave, you know, it was the radio in those days. It was what sounded good on the radio. So you
had
a thinner sort of sound.
Yeah,
you wouldn't.
Yeah, no, it's true. I know what you mean about the way.
Yeah.
But it's made, but the whole thing is like that response vocal is like no one else could do that. That's just so you.
Yeah. I think Ronno did the strings on Sea Diver. That's what I think.
Right.
It was.
Yeah.
But going back to what makes All the Young Dudes so special and was so special for me and Guy growing up as kids was the fact that it was talking about kids we knew. It was talking about Top of the Pops. It was talking about T-Rex. You know, it was Wendy. And Freddie, who, you know, I've since met Wendy Kirby, who it was about, and Freddie Beretti was obviously Freddie. Did you know any of those kids at the time, or were they just did Bowie explain?
A couple of times. I went to Haddon Hall a couple of times. It wasn't my scene, you know. But I met Fred, we used to drop him off at Hampstead Heath, you know.
He designed Bowie's clothes, didn't he, Freddie? He was fantastic.
Yeah. I think David wanted him to be a rock star, you know. I think that was the plan. I'm not sure.
It was, because he wrote Ziggy Stardust originally for Freddie Beretti, didn't he?
Okay.
Moon Age Daydream.
I used to hang out with Angie. Angie was more my cup of tea. She was a lot of fun. We used to get, you know, we used to have a few wines and stuff like that. And my wife used to hang out with Angie, you know. That was more normal. Angie was outrageous, but she was normal. You know, Dave was, he always had that thing. He was like, he's so ambitious. Very generous with his time and everything, but so ambitious, you know.
Yeah. But Ian, it's not just that song and it's not just the lyrics. It's also the way you sang it, that voice of yours, you know, that which is a very English voice and with such kind of decadent passion. And I still put that record on now. I mean, you can, can't you, Guy? You put it on. It's a Desert Island Disc one for me. And I can feel the hair stand up on my arms still. It's forever is the anthem of my youth.
It's still around. That's something for the song, you know, like 50 years.
Where did you first meet Ronno? Because I did hear you'd previously bumped into him, hadn't you, at the Flamingo Club. Is that right? Is that true?
Oh, isn't there an On the Stairs thing, Passing on the Stairs?
Yeah, Miller Anderson was with me at the time, you know, and Miller said, this is Mick Ronson. You know, I mean, he was with a religious cult band at the time, The Voice, Mick was.
Oh.
And got a bit silly. A mix, you know, a northern land. Well, it was three amps and a van, you know what I mean? And when they started trying to, you know, separate him from, I think Susie it was, or whoever he was. This is way back. And he left. And I think they moved to, like, I don't know, South America or something. It was a cult. But the guy, you got free gear, you know, and then you represented the cult. They were called The Voice. And then... I never saw him again until, you know, with Bowie. And we got on great. And when he left, you know, when David decided that was it, it just seemed a natural idea, you know, to play with him, you know, because I knew how good he was.
Mott are still going at this point, right? I mean, Mott have still got some
Mott going. Bender's in the band, Luther Grosvenor, who used to walk into this fantastic, you know, the great Aerial Bender thing. The show was great. I mean, the show went up 20%. Musically, I couldn't work with Luther somehow, like I worked with Mick. But Ronson,
Luther is Aerial Bender, right? Luther is Aerial Bender.
Yeah,
the great Aerial Bender.
Yeah.
Still one of the great names, isn't it?
Yeah. Who came up with the name Aerial Bender, Ian?
It's a girl singer now. Then you've got me. She's not with us.
Oh, right. Lindsay DePaul.
Yeah, that was it, Lindsay. Because we were in Germany, and we were fed up. And I remember the street, and there was a horse's trough down the bottom of the street, and Ralpha just bent every car aerial in the entire street with frustration from this stupid gig we were doing, and then put his head in the horse's trough at the bottom of the street, you know. He's looking at this, and she turned around to me, she said, Aerial Bender. and was like, yes, I'll hold that. You know how you do if you write songs. Yeah. I'll hold that name, you know. And then I said to Luther, do you want to join Martin? He said, yeah, why not? And we were in a Hampstead pub. And I said, I love your name, Luther Grosvenor. What a great name. And he said, yeah. I said, we want to change it. We want to call you Ariel Bender. And he went, yeah. I was told 100%, you know, he just did this complete turn from a serious guitar player into the great Ariel Bender, you know.
That's fantastic. Because now you're in your pomp, aren't you, really? I mean, because that's what I think surprised everybody, because we all went, oh, all the young dudes, you know, that's fantastic, but it's written by Bowie, you know, what else have they got? But you easily surpass it. You come up, you know, all the way from Memphis, Honolulu Boogie, Roll Away the Stone. I mean, these were like great moments in our lives, weren't they, Guy?
Well, there's things like, for instance, that, I mean, gonna bring your records. Yeah, will do. It's always gonna be in my head forever. Yeah. You know, there's all those little they were fantastic snippets.
Who were those BV girls?
A marionette. I ain't done yet. That whole thing. It just stays with you forever.
Who were those women who did all the BVs on all those records then, Ian?
Thunder thighs.
That's it.
Yeah. They were great girls. Really nice. I think. I don't know where we got them from. I think it might have been Roxy. I'm not sure.
Mm. Where are they still around?
I can't imagine Brian being happy with a group being called Thunder Thigh.
I don't know if they're still around. I think one of them died. But you're going back a long, long way now. My memory's not that great. Maybe
it's doing pretty well so far, mate.
Yeah. we mentioned your connection with Freddie and Roger Taylor and stuff, but they, because they actually supported you, didn't they? Were you the sort of, did you know who you had supporting you? Could you tell that it was going, how good it was going to, they were going to turn out?
I used to have a bath before we went on, so I'd only get to the gig like for their last two songs, and I always felt a little guilty because they would go, what do you think, and I was like, yeah, I think, but I heard Keep Yourself Alive and Liar every night. You know, that was the last two songs. And they were like, what do you think? And all of us. And I'm like, yeah, you know, but in truth, I didn't know if they were going to make it any more than anybody else did, except the fans, you know. They seemed to have an extraordinary fan power, you know. I mean, they only went once and you were there the second, you know. The place was full the second time. Yeah. And Fred was gorgeous, you know. They were lovely people to be with, all of them.
Yeah, well, of course, they then turn up on your solo album, don't they?
Well, you know, you do a lot of touring. We toured in the States with them, and it gets boring, and it's really nice if the support band's kind of like you lot, you know. I mean, I think they were very like us, only a little more intelligent and a little more focused, you know.
I don't think they had Bo Rap at that point, did they? I'm sure they didn't.
I don't know. We just got on with them instinctively straight away. I mean, and they're bright people for a start, you know, brighter than we were. They had it planned, you know. They knew what they were going to do, yeah.
We think Brian's guitar style, you know, it's not a million miles away from Mick Rouse and from what Mick Ronson, and, you know, there was definitely a very melodic guitar style that was coming out that wasn't just noodling on the blues, was it?
Well, you know, it's like there's two kind of guitar players. One's playing for himself and the other's playing for the song. And all those guys you mentioned, you know, they play for the song.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. You know, I couldn't stand playing with somebody who just plays for the sake of going up and down a fretboard 100 miles an hour. You know, a lot of them thrash metal things and all that. It doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, that Campbell, going back to Mike Campbell, you know, he improves everything he plays on. He just makes it sound better.
Yeah, his riffs have always been just legend. Just he just comes up with that thing, doesn't he? That makes
I mean, it was so surprised to me. It was like I had a wide smile, you know. It was like, geez, I knew it'd be good, but I didn't know it'd be that good, you know.
Was there any, you're talking about your latest album, was there sort of negotiations during that? Would you say, do you know, could you try it a bit more like this? Or did it come back and that was the sort of, that was it?
If there was any intelligence involved, it was sending the right track to the right people.
That's right.
You know.
Yeah. Oh, talking about, can I make one, sorry, this is way off the beam, but there's one lovely little bit of symmetry to do with this, which is you have Robert Trujillo playing bass on one track, and he's actually playing Jaco's legendary old bass, which is what he played on All American.
Really?
Alien Boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty special.
Yeah.
Or he's playing the least Jacko-y bit. He does one little, there's one bit of, I'm a bass player, I'm listening out for this stuff.
Yeah.
There's one bit where he gets a bit fusion, just for a second.
So how did you know? he's playing Jacko's bass?
I think it was somewhere in the press release, Gary.
I missed that. I miss anything to do with bass.
I instinctively knew. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah.
Well, listen, okay, I'm going to throw in another little bass curveball because otherwise this isn't going to come up. But like, because you always have, you know, you always had amazing musicians. But I just suddenly found the one album of yours that you can't find to stream, which is Why You I Oughta.
Yeah.
Bernard Edwards. What?
Why can't we find that anywhere, Ian?
Yeah, what's going on, Ian?
I don't know. It's Columbia. That would be Columbia, right? No, Dick Ashley was out of Columbia and he kept on getting fired because he didn't agree with Payola. And it was most annoying, you know, because you'd sort of make a record and then he'd get fired. And, you know, there'd be no promo, there'd be no, you know, it happened twice. He was a good record man, but he just wouldn't play.
He just wouldn't do the Payola thing?
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if he did that, because that happened with Pink Floyd when they put, as an experiment, when they put out Brick in the Wall. Which just went to number one everywhere immediately. But Steve O'Rourke, the manager, turned up in LA and it just wasn't on the radio anywhere at all.
Yeah.
Because they hadn't done the Payola thing. And they thought this would be big enough. But nothing was. Nothing was too big for Payola. Yeah.
I think they were doing it and then they decided to stop. And that was it. It just cut, you know. And
yeah, it's incredible.
Marketing.
Ian, one of the greatest YouTube clips. I wasn't, unfortunately, there for the show, although I have friends who were there. But one of the great YouTube clips is definitely at Freddie Mercury tribute concert when you and Bowie and Queen and Mick Ronson play all the young dudes. I mean, I can watch that on loop endlessly. What a buzz that was. And I think, you correct me if I'm wrong, it's Ronno's last performance, isn't it? I mean, tell us about that. Tell us about that evening and that event.
It was big. I mean, there was 4,000 crew. It was like a city backstage. I sat in the Queen's box for the first half with Mick and the girls. And we rehearsed for a week, I think, at Pinewood, somewhere like that, a film studio. People, sportsmen were turning up and golfers and, you know, all kinds of people coming. It was interesting. And David was sitting there with his girl taking notes of everything. And it was a fantastic week. And then the gig itself... Roger was a little fast, but we did all right, you know.
But Mick was fantastic. It was his last outing, wasn't it?
Yeah, Heroes. And when he got on guitar, it all disappeared, all the pain and you know that he was going through. I mean, when he got on guitar, it was straight away Mick. You just sort of look on his face. I mean, it has to be right, though.
Yeah, because you wrote that brilliant tribute to him, didn't you? Michael Picasso, which is a wonderful song, very honest, open song.
Well, he's your mate, you know. He's a big mate of mine for 17 years.
I know, it's lovely, because he's so shat, you know, he was so much part of all those albums going forward, wasn't he?
He's anything he touched, you know. He was, I don't really like talking about him because it's at least 2 or 3 hours. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was such a character.
Someone I feel that we have to mention is another Rock on Tour guest and a mutual friend of me and guys is Joe Elliott, who's, ever since I've known Joe since the 80s, he's held you as his greatest hero and he ends up singing a lot with you as well, doesn't he?
Oh, he nagged his manager into managing me, you know. He's an unstoppable force, you know. I mean, this probably wouldn't have happened, this whole thing, if it wasn't for Joe.
Really?
Well, yeah, because I Mott 74 did a gig in New York, and then I did 4 nights at the Winery for my 80th, and he brought his manager, Mike, and Mike asked to manage me the following day. I'm 80 years old, and you want to manage me? You know, like, it was ridiculous, you know.
Yeah.
And he said, "Yeah, I want to manage you if you wouldn't mind," you know. And it all basically started there, you know, and then. Can I sing on something? And I'm like, so I send him 7 tracks, tell him exactly what to do, and he does it.
Bless him.
Except one, there's a track called, what's the painter?
Guernica.
Is it Guernica?
Guernica, yeah, the middle.
Guernica.
Yeah, all I got was an email.
Fantastic song, by the way, really beautiful song.
Yeah, I got an email from Joe, like, can I do a Queenie on it? So that's the whole middle section, he's done a Queenie on it.
when you were playing at Hammersmith and he'd get up every night and do all the young dudes.
Yeah.
I was kind of waiting for you to sing it.
he got a lot of flack for a while there because when everybody realized it was genuine, you know.
Of course it was. It's obviously the reasons he wanted to be there.
I saw you at the O2 as well, Ian. You know, it's always sad because everyone looks so full of life, and then you know Overon goes and. Mick's still with us. What's the lineup at the moment? And is Mott going out again?
I wouldn't think so, no, because I got tinnitus real bad, you know. I think Mick's been sitting in bed for 6 years. It's boring, you know, that's what he says. It's boring.
Wow.
And last time I spoke to him, he said slight improvement. But it's very difficult, you know.
Oh, very, right. So he's not well, Mick.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I'm not there, you know. But we talk to his wife now and again, you know, and she takes him out. He goes out into Henley now and again.
Oh, Jesus!
It's not six years in a bed. Oh,
what about you? Are you taking this album out? Is Defiance Part One going out? Part Two?
I don't know. I mean, we haven't finished part two. We're about 60-70% through. You know, there's still other people involved. And
still lining up monster names to appear on it.
Right, so.
They're still coming in.
Well, Ian, mate, I think part three, part four, we're looking forward to them all. Honestly, I swear to God, this album was such a joy to listen to. And anyone who loves Ian Hunter is not going to be disappointed with this. You're giving more pearls to the world.
Well, I hope more people are thinking the same way as you do.
Sure they are.
We shall see. Comes out April.
Thank you. There's a couple of tracks. There's a couple of tracks that you can go and get right. I mean, Better Roses is out there.
Yeah,
right.
You can get I Hate Hate and you can get Better Roses. And the next one is Pavlov's Dog.
Fantastic.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, fantastic.
Fantastic. Love that. Listen, thanks, Ian.
Yeah, yeah.
That was an absolute joy. Thank you so much for talking to us. It's brilliant.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You're such an important part of our life.
Ian,
thank you for
everything. If you come to London, can we take you for tea?
Yes. Well, tea. All right.
Or whatever. A slap-up meal.
Dom was up here, you know.
Who?
Dom Brown.
Was it? Oh, right. Oh, from Duran.
From Duran.
Yes.
He's up here. All right.
Ian.
Brilliant.
Oh. Thank you.
All right. You're very welcome.
Fabulous.
Yeah, really fabulous. Oh, my God. What a night, you know.
Okay, but there's loads of stuff we didn't get to because there's actually... Because all of the, you know, I had stuff prepared for all the different solo albums. Yeah. You know, he's got the E Street Band on one. He's got, you know, this...
Our producer texts us and says we've got to wrap up.
Yeah, because he hates us.
Ian's on a math.
He's busy. He's got things to do. He's got other people to talk
to. A million podcasts, but only this one counts, of course. But
slightly worrying about the Dom Brown thing.
Well, do you think he thought I played in Duran Duran?
Do you think he thought you have played for the other lot?
Did he?
I don't know.
No, we beat him 7-0 yesterday. No, sorry. Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet have never had a football match, but if they did,
if there's one thing missing from the pop history books, it's that
we played. It was a Christmas day. We played between the trenches.
That's right. It was all peaceful until the midweeks came out.
No, I mean, listen, this has been a joy going back and listening to those albums because, oh my God, what a lyricist this man is. What a songwriter he is. And
you said to me before, Gary, I mean, he is kind of the English Springsteen, isn't he? But I want to say, he does this thing that actually, I mean, Pete Townsend is kind of the other guy who does this, which is writing songs about music.
Yeah. And he's done this a lot, hasn't he? I mean, Cleveland Rocks, I mean, there's so many, you know, Saturday Gigs, obviously, you know, all the way from Memphis. And on the new album, there's a few. Better Roses and the
Gonna
last one.
Bring Your Records? Will do. Yeah. I mean, that's
Did you love the bit when he came on the pod?
It's an eternal earworm.
When he came on, he went, hello. And it was great. Once bitten, twice shy. Thank you to our producer Ben Jones for Gimme Sugar, and thank you for all you guys listening to us. We must say, you know, follow us on Instagram, on Twitter. I thought you were on Facebook. I'm not on Facebook personally, but are we on Facebook?
I am on Facebook. I do my own posts on Facebook. I'm out there on the front lines of Facebook.
Thank you for that.
But you know, sweet old fashioned thing that I am. And we should warn you, I think we're taking a break next week because we're just too busy. Some of us are just too busy.
Yes, some of us are too busy. Some of us are going to be treading the boards for a brief moment before you tread the boards, I hear. I think it's been on the news,
hasn't it?
Been on the news.
Well, yes.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
Anyway, thanks to everyone. It's a good night from me.
And it's a good night from them.
Rockanteurs is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.